Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. And welcome to Bali. I'm standing on the famous Kuta Beach. And as far as the eye can see, there are thousands of people, many of them Australians, lolling in the blazing afternoon sunshine here on this glorious day. We're here in Bali for the 9th International Conference on AIDS in the Asia-Pacific region.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me begin by extending a very warm welcome to all of you to this island of Bali, Indonesia.
President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono of Indonesia welcomes conference delegates on the first night with a speech that has momentous implications for our region and for the world. Listen as the leader of the world's largest Muslim country not only refers openly to injecting drug users, sex workers, and men who have sex with men, but speaks about these at-risk groups in a positive and inclusive way as part of the solution to his country's growing HIV epidemic.
I am informed by the National AIDS Commission that there are now 5 national networks. Positive women, people living with HIV, survivor of injecting drug use, sex workers, and the network of gay, transgender and men who have sex with men. They are all actively involved in planning, implementing, monitoring and evaluating the national response. This is precisely the kind of partnership that we need.
President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono of Indonesia. There are 4,000 delegates here at the 9th International Conference on AIDS in Asia and the Pacific. UN officials, politicians, health bureaucrats, social workers and AIDS activists. And everywhere you look, milling around these hallways, here at Bali's International Convention Centre, there are young Southeast Asian women glued to their mobile phones, young men from the Pacific Islands with shell beads in their hair, Indian women in saris, Catholic nuns from Korea, and here and there, the glamorous transgenders or fafafine of the Pacific. There's been a real sense of taking stock at this conference and a real sense of social and cultural change in the air. For one thing, there's new leadership at the United Nations Task Force on AIDS. The highly regarded Mali-born Michelle Sidibe is the first African to lead UNAIDS. And there's also the pressure of the global economic downturn. It's estimated that there are around 33 million people in the world living with HIV, and that 2.7 million people are newly infected every year. That's 7,000 new infections each day. In fact, the AIDS pandemic is continuing to grow faster than the rollout of antiretroviral drugs. And for this reason, the new head of UNAIDS, Michelle Sidibe, says there needs to be a much more serious focus on preventing HIV infection rather than just treating it after it happens.
Unless we put the prevention to the center of our response will not make a big difference. It will not be sustainable. Anytime we are putting 2 people on treatment, we have 5 new infections. That is the pressure areas for me.
As I was a judge for 34 years in my country, Australia.
Also with a blunt message, former Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby is here in Bali arguing that in the long run, this situation is unsustainable. And now, because of the global economic downturn, there has to be a serious refocusing of attention on HIV prevention.
If you were continuing to get growth in GDP, then maybe you could continue to fund antiretroviral drugs at the huge cost that that entails, and the Global Fund would keep on giving the treatment. But with the global economic downturn, particularly hitting hard the developing countries, the plain fact of the matter is the world is not going to go on funding this ever-increasing cohort, and therefore there's going to be pressure on all countries to do something serious about prevention of further spread of HIV, and that's something they just have brushed under the carpet.
Meanwhile, in our own region, the big news is that AIDS is taking off again. In fact, the number of people living with HIV in Asia is set to double by the end of the decade. The nature of the epidemic in Asia is also changing. Increasingly, it's becoming an epidemic of men who have sex with men. And by 2020, it's expected that men who have sex with men will make up half of all the new infections in the Asia-Pacific region, overtaking injecting drug users and the sex industry as the source of new infections. Don Baxter is director of the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations, and he was in Bali. He says HIV infection rates among men who have sex with men are skyrocketing in many big Asian cities, especially in Bangkok and the Burmese city of Yangon or Rangoon.
Bangkok and Yangon are really disaster areas where infection rates among gay and bisexual men in those cities is over 30%. We then have a series of cities that are approaching or just gone over 20%. Big places, Beijing is like that, Mumbai is over 20%. And then we have a series who are running really between 5 to 15 or 20%. That's where most of the big Asian cities are. Jakarta, Ho Chi Minh City, Hanoi. Every one of the big cities we look at is getting above 5%. And then there's probably 25 Chinese cities who are on that takeoff level as well.
I thought Thailand was one of the good news stories for HIV in our region. Why is the HIV rate amongst men who have sex with men in Bangkok so out of kilter with that broader story in Thailand?
Well, it's actually a political story. When the Thaksin government came to power, they initiated what was called the Social Order Campaign, and the effect of that was to actually remove condoms from all of the parks and sexual venues among gay men, because the possession of condoms was enforced as evidence of prostitution, and the sex venues removed all condoms, and the gay men certainly didn't take condoms with them because they'd be prosecuted or basically be extorted by the police. And that went on for 4 or 5 years, and it's only recently stopped. So the infection rate went up very rapidly in Bangkok to now over 30%.
The United Nations Commission on AIDS in Asia has criticised what it calls the complacent view that Asia's conservative laws and values will be enough to keep the epidemic in check in our region. The truth is that injecting drug use is widespread in Asia despite the draconian penalties. It's also rather conservatively estimated that there are around 16 million men who have sex with men in Asia. But in a region where gay rights movements are very new and very small, many men who regularly have sex with men also have female partners. Particularly in Confucian societies like China and Korea, gay men often find themselves under strong pressure to marry and raise a family. What this means is that the AIDS virus is now bearing down on up to 50 million Asian wives and girlfriends. Don Baxter.
So given the rates of infections among homosexually active men, then it is inevitable that those female partners, or a significant number of them, are going to become infected. So in China, for instance, more than 50% of gay and bisexual men are either married or have a regular female sexual partner. In Australia, I think our figure is less than 6%. So the flow-on infections arising from sex between men in Asia is going to be much greater than it was in this country.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon.
Perhaps the person who's done most to set the tone for the 9th International Conference on AIDS in Asia and the Pacific isn't even in Bali, and that's the United Nations Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon.
I'm honoured and humbled to stand here among so many leaders.
It's being said that Ban Ki-moon is emerging as one of the finest Secretary Generals the UN has ever had. Certainly, he's making some pretty extraordinary speeches that haven't received a lot of media attention, like this one in 2008, when he called on all the governments in the world to decriminalise drugs, homosexuality and commercial sex.
One-third of countries still do not have laws to protect people living with HIV. In most countries, discrimination remains legal against women, men who have sex with men, sex workers, drug users, and ethnic minorities. This must change.
In particular, Ban Ki-moon points to what's become known as the AIDS paradox, that the way to beat the AIDS pandemic isn't to punish people whose behaviour puts them at risk, but to empower them and work with them. In fact, he says there's a high correlation between successful HIV prevention and law reform.
In countries without laws to protect sex workers, drug users, and men who have sex with men, only a fraction of the population has access to prevention. Conversely, in countries with legal protection and the protection of human rights for these people, many more have access to services. As a result, there are fewer infections, less demand for antiretroviral treatment, and fewer deaths. Not only is this unethical, not to protect these groups, it makes no sense from a health perspective. It hurts all of us all.
The world is on the threshold of a new third era in the global fight against AIDS, according to Australia's former High Court judge, Michael Kirby.
People like me are fed up. We've had too much of second-class status.
He says the first era was all about alerting the world to the epidemic in the days before life-saving drugs were available. The second era began in 1996 with the establishment of UNAIDS, and it was all about making treatment available wherever it was needed.
Now we're in the third era, which is the era that will not tolerate 2.7 million people getting infected every year. And that means the third era has to concentrate on prevention, and that means embracing the AIDS paradox and getting back to supporting and getting into the minds of the people who are at risk in the vulnerable populations. So that's the third era. It's the hardest challenge because for many of these societies, it's a challenge to their religion, to their modesty, to their cultural norms, to their acceptance of the binary situation of men and women, all the things that we've gone through in Australia in a relatively tolerant and accepting society. These are not happy messages in communities of very strong religious norms that go back to ancient books and say that's it. But they've got to take the hard measures that we took in Australia 20 years ago. And the question is, do they have the leadership that will do that? And I think that's why the statement by not only the President of Indonesia, but also the First Lady of Indonesia at the opening of this conference in Bali was so important. That is giving leadership in a region that has really lacked it. And I think a lot of the stimulus to the leadership that's necessary is going to come from the plain, cold economic facts that they can't afford and will not get from the international community the money to get the antiretrovirals to the ever-increasing cohort who are infected.
But Michael Kirby is also warning gay people who support law reform that they need to be rigorous in their arguments and wary of sub-agendas. He says this is a story about public health and international donors getting the best possible return on their investment, not a story about everyone being nice to gay people.
It's a matter of being very honest about the need in this particular context, HIV containment, prevention, of being very honest that we're not here as such in the human rights business. If so, you'd do that in the political branches, the United Nations or the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Here we're dealing with the issue of AIDS, and therefore we have to be rigorous as to whether this is a strategy, A, that will be accepted, and B, that will work in this region. And in those countries that have taken these steps of decriminalisation, they have seen their graph of HIV seroconversions fall. And that's a sign that it does work. But whether you can get it off the ground in countries of Asia Pacific, that is the big question.
It's been very striking to hear how optimistic many of the leading delegates are here at the Bali Conference about the idea that AIDS can be a driver of social and cultural change. Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta is president of the International Centre for Research on Women, and she made the extraordinary statement that AIDS has already done more for the status of women in the developing world than any other issue in recent decades.
I've worked in the gender and development field for over 3 decades now, and I can tell you that the attention that AIDS has given the issue of gender inequality, I haven't seen that in like agriculture or water and sanitation or any of the other fields of development.
You know, in a way, this is the central message of the new third era of AIDS, that because AIDS feeds on discrimination, fighting discrimination has to become a central focus of public health policy. Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta.
There's a growing realization that the fault lines that already exist in society that have caused the inequities that have existed for decades are the very fault lines on which the HIV virus feeds. And that unless we do something about those fundamental inequities, all of these other solutions, including treatment, are not going to really contain the epidemic. If you pay attention to those social drivers and figure out ways to address them, that could be the game changer in the epidemic.
If you want to see the kind of rapid change in social and cultural attitudes that will characterise the third era of AIDS, you don't need to look any further than Thailand, which was the first nation in Asia to develop a coordinated national response to the epidemic. The Thai people these days are much more open to public discussions about sex than they once used to be. John Ungphakorn is a member of the Senate of Thailand and the founder of Thailand's AIDS Access Foundation. He says that while Thailand's famous mainstream condom campaign is often credited with being the big factor behind Thailand's success in turning the epidemic around in the 1990s, it wasn't the only factor. Perhaps even more important was the empowerment of female sex workers. John Ungphakorn.
Well, Thailand is praised for its condom campaign in the sex industry. I think that did make an achievement, but what made the most achievement, I think, was the change in the sex industry itself, whereby brothels where sex workers were bonded, got very low pay, had to take a lot of customers, were closed down, forcibly closed down. But there was encouragement for opening new kinds of sex establishments, the indirect sex establishments, such as karaoke bars, where sex workers could get tips from singing with customers and so on. They would take fewer customers, they would have more freedom to choose and to negotiate with customers, and therefore they had much better protection against HIV/AIDS. And the figures showed it, that between direct sex workers and indirect sex workers, there was about a 5 times gap in the number of infections with HIV. Unfortunately, there are still some of the old types of brothels in existence, and they are mainly staffed by migrant sex workers, who are, of course, one of the most vulnerable groups that exist, as being both migrant workers, not allowed to change their sex establishment, not having papers, and having to accept whoever customers are given to them.
And they don't get access to HIV treatment.
They don't get access to HIV treatment, and all of this means that they are systematically subjected to exploitation.
Life before profit! Life before profit!
These days you don't see much of the vocal political activism that gave the early AIDS conferences of the 1980s so much urgency and energy. That's dissipated. So when this small demonstration briefly interrupted proceedings inside the main auditorium a few moments ago, even the speakers on stage seemed to cheer up. Now the protesters have spilled out into the hallways outside, and they're calling for action on international patent law to make cheaper hepatitis C drugs more available. The governments of India, Thailand and Brazil have already forced the big pharmaceutical companies to agree to compulsory licenses for the production of cheaper generic versions of some HIV drugs. And not surprisingly, that's raised public expectations that more action will follow.
I'm Siva Frailapam from Asia Pacific Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS, and we work for access to treatment for HIV positive people. Today, we have been facing a lot of troubles in access to hepatitis C treatment because it's patented, the drug is not affordable by a majority of the people, and that's why we are asking break the patents.
Yes, there are some governments in the region that you're very applauding of and other governments that you're very critical of.
We were praising the Thai government, but on the other hand, Singapore, for example, positive people in Singapore have to pay for HIV drugs. And a lot of them are flying into Thailand or elsewhere to buy the cheaper generic drugs. So some of the governments are not supportive of all these issues.
China gets a lot of criticism in relation to HIV.
Chinese government is horrible. I have to say that. There are a lot of horrible things going on. Even when it comes to harm reduction work for drug users, corpses hanging around outside the drop-in centers. So people are not able to come forward to access services, including clean needles, meaning people's, a lot of people ended up sharing needles, and ultimately they get HIV. And that sort of things needs to stop now.
Police harassment of AIDS activists and community organisations is unheard of in Australia, but it's a serious problem in many parts of Asia. Raymond Tai is executive director of Malaysia's Pink Triangle Foundation, and he's part of a coalition of NGOs who are appealing to the international community to intervene. He says the Pink Triangle Foundation is funded by the Malaysian Health Department, but its volunteer outreach workers are routinely arrested by the Malaysian police.
In the last 6 weeks, we have had detentions and raids from the police that had made it difficult for our outreach workers to do what they need to do and for us to promote 100% access to condoms in gay men's saunas. Many saunas in Malaysia operate as a gym or a spa, and they need to be licensed by law, and this license is provided on a yearly basis, and for the slightest of reasons they can refuse you the licensing.
And so if your organisation is in those gay bars or those gay saunas bringing condoms in, does that actually cause a problem for them?
Yes, many of the operators of these places are hesitant to work with us for those very reasons, because they know that if they have condoms available in their premises, they could be easy prey or easy ground for the police to come and make life difficult for them. So in some of the saunas, they have said, no, we don't want your condoms on our premises, because the last time that happened, we got into a lot of trouble with the authorities.
Putting an end to tactics such as these is precisely what the third era of AIDS will be all about. On ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. This is Background Briefing. I'm Stephen Crittenden, and we're in Bali at the 9th International Conference on AIDS in Asia and the Pacific. In their 2005 meeting at Glen Eagles, the leaders of the world's richest nations, the G8, committed themselves to achieving universal access to antiretroviral drugs by 2010. But in spite of a huge effort and some huge progress in a few of the world's poorest countries, life-saving antiretroviral therapy is still only available to about a third of the people in the developing world who need it. So far, the leaders of the G8 have met their commitments more or less. But the question now is what happens after 2010? Dr. Julio Montaner is president of the International AIDS Society and a leading advocate of universal treatment. In recent months, he's been highly critical of the G8 leadership. Julio Montaner wasn't able to come to the Bali conference, so we rang his office in Vancouver.
We now know that it is highly unlikely, in fact, it's a fact, that we are not going to meet our universal access target by the year 2010. And the problem is not just that we are falling behind, it's that the epidemic is growing faster than we are actually able to put people on antiretroviral therapy, number one. And number two is that if you look at what happened at the last GA meeting in L'Aquila in Italy, basically HIV and AIDS was dropped from the agenda. There was really no recommitment in terms of where we're going with this effort. If we abandon those who are infected with HIV to their own devices, we will not fix the epidemic. And there is no human right that is more clear in my mind that the right of people infected with HIV to treatment.
There's a reason for the note of desperation in Dr. Montaner's voice. He knows people are losing interest and that there's no guarantee that the United States Congress will continue to vote to fund an ever-expanding budget for treatment. He also knows that it's getting harder to make the case to the donor countries when a number of recipient countries are significantly reducing their own AIDS budgets. Swaziland has reduced its treatment targets by 10%. Tanzania is talking about a 20% cut. And Papua New Guinea has already cut its AIDS budget by over 50%. Dr. Julio Montaner.
Unfortunately, governments around the world are vacillating in terms of what the next step should be regarding HIV and AIDS. For the reasons that everyone understands, people are scrambling to pay the bills, and you don't have to go to PNG or Tanzania to see this. Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, actually has drastically reduced HIV funding, including antiretroviral therapy programs. Shame on him. Shame on him, because he should be leading the charge. His country actually has been in a leadership position, even during the Bush administration, believe it or not, in terms of supporting antiretroviral therapy around the world. And it is unbelievable that Schwarzenegger, of all people, has backed away from his earlier commitments regarding this.
It's been very interesting to observe the Australian activists and policymakers at this conference in Bali. Their presence is low-key, and you can't help feeling that's deliberate. Every one of the 4,000 delegates in this room is fully aware of how successful Australia has been in containing its own HIV epidemic. And everyone in the room knows how it was done. 25 years ago, Australia took some difficult policy decisions and introduced harm reduction strategies targeting gay men and injecting drug users. Here in Bali, the message of the Australians is quiet and practical, but it's growing more insistent. Now it's time for the countries of the developing world to take the same hard decisions. As a policy advisor to the Hawke and Keating governments, Bill Botell was one of the key architects of Australia's bipartisan policy on AIDS in the 1980s. Now working as a consultant with the Lowy Institute, he says an important and necessary confrontation is looming between what he calls the care and treatment lobby and those who understand that the universal care and treatment model is doomed. For 25 years, he says, the international community has paid lip service to the issue of prevention. But now, the global economic downturn has brought the issue back into view.
I think people are trying to kid themselves that this is now stabilised and that the models that are developed over the last 10 years are the models that will work. And we just need to keep on doing much the same old thing in the same old way. There is an impasse, a failure to understand the fundamental nature of what we are dealing with. It is in the interests of a lot of people to talk about care and treatment exclusively as the response to HIV. It generates money, it generates research, it generates care and treatment services. All of these things are good things, they're not bad things. But the limitations of the model are now being reached, and the financial crisis, the economic crisis, shows us that entirely. If you are going to concentrate on care and treatment and not prevention, we are going to chase our tail forever. Now, we have to have a situation where the incentives are changed, where there is an incentive to prevent. And we have not done that. Prevention, in money terms, in the last 25 years, is the little bit left over at the end.
And what's so difficult about prevention language?
Well, the problem with prevention is you have to take a mature, grown-up approach to sex and drugs. Young people have sex and they do drugs. And I don't care if they're in Iran or South Africa or Afghanistan or Australia or Samoa. That's what they tend to do. And that is not going to change dramatically. Whatever pious hopes older people have or cultural leaders or religious leaders or whatever. Now, the point with HIV and AIDS is if you go to young people and say, the solution to this is not to have sex and not to do drugs, well, we've seen the result of that in the last 25 years. Literally millions and millions of people infected or dead as a result of this ideologically bankrupt set of policies. Now, these things have to change. And unfortunately, in much of the world, politicians and political leaders have tried to shy away from the hard questions involved with sex and drugs.
These days, according to Bill Botell, nothing much of any importance gets decided at big international AIDS conferences like this one in Bali. That's because of the vice-like grip of what he calls the Iron Triangle, the care and treatment coalition made up of politicians, drug companies, and the recipients of drug treatment. At the centre of the Iron Triangle, dominating everything, says Bill Botell, are the doctors. Being doctors, it's not surprising that they always support treatment and don't really understand prevention. But the world's politicians, and even big donors like Bill Gates, are beginning to realise that endlessly expanding treatment budgets make for poor public policy. Bill Botell.
So if you like, the Care and Treatment Coalition, the people who are interested above all in care and treatment, that political line now predominates in these conferences for completely understandable and supportable reasons. Nobody wants a world in which any person who requires care and treatment for HIV doesn't get it. That's important. But beyond that, my argument is care and treatment of itself has the incentive to create the caseload, an expanding caseload. It is a feedback loop. The more you pay for care and treatment, not surprisingly, over time, the higher the caseload. Because what we've done by concentrating that is let politicians and others off the hook on prevention. Prevention is cheaper, easier, and works like a charm. And you have to ask a question after 25 years in this business, why haven't people done it?
Well, as we've heard, one of the leading figures on the other side of the argument is Dr. Julio Montaner from the International AIDS Society. He wants to argue not only that universal access to antiretroviral treatment is a highly cost-effective use of resources, but that HIV treatment is itself a form of prevention. And to some extent, he's quite right. A cheap 6 months course of the drug nevirapine can stop pregnant HIV-positive women from passing the virus onto their unborn babies. And patients who are getting HIV treatment are generally a lot less infectious than those who aren't. But so far, there's not much evidence that the treatment is prevention argument really stacks up when it comes to halting a global pandemic in its tracks. So what does Julio Montaner think of the arguments that are being put by Australians like Bill Botell and Michael Kirby, that the world isn't going to go on funding treatment for an ever-expanding pandemic, and that there has to be a new focus on prevention and human rights instead?
I cannot accept that. And let's be also perfectly clear that behaviour modification is a very difficult thing. You can start preaching behavior change, and you can start emphasizing the importance of changing the human rights approaches and so on and so forth. And all of that is essential and is very important. But we have something that has been proven to work. So if we will put treatment on the back burner for the next decade, because we say we cannot afford it, and start just focusing on the social aspects and the educational aspects or the human rights aspects, I have news for you. We will not conquer HIV.
Meanwhile, one senior United Nations official who seems open to the prospect of a confrontation between treatment and prevention is the Deputy Executive Director of the United Nations Population Fund, Dr. Panima Mane. In fact, you're about to hear her make an extremely important admission.
When we began in this epidemic, we didn't have treatment. And then when treatment became available, we, of course, spent a lot of time on making sure that more people had access to it. But during that period, we lost vital time because we stopped talking about prevention. We stopped investing in prevention. We stopped trying to address the structural factors in prevention and, in fact, made the epidemic, in a sense, worse.
The Bali conference takes place in the immediate aftermath of a major court decision in India when the High Court of New Delhi overturned Section 377 of the Indian Criminal Code, which outlaws sex between men, a law that had been in place since British colonial times. And one of the stars of the conference in Bali was lawyer Anand Grover, who led the case before the High Court of New Delhi. He says the decision has become symbolic for the entire region.
The amazing thing about the Delhi High Court judgment is that it was given by a developing country in which that law was first enacted or instituted or applied by the British. And that law, not only in terms of content, the exact words that are used and the section numbers are replicated not only in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, but also in the Caribbean. So a large number of the Commonwealth countries have the same law. So therefore, it is definitely on the agenda within the judicial and the legal community.
In other words, it's been put on the agenda now for a whole range of other countries.
Well, informally, it's already put on the agenda. Formally, it is being put on the agenda by various stakeholders like the UN system. But informally, I can tell you that because it's a judgment which has been highly publicized, not only in India but elsewhere in the world, judges are reading it across the world, which actually means that they start thinking differently. Unless you change the mindset of the legal community, which includes judges, you won't get very far. I think that's what's happening now.
What's so important about the legal case against India's Section 377 is that it wasn't just a case about gay rights. In fact, it was fought on public health grounds. It's highly significant that Anand Grover, the lawyer who argued the case, is also United Nations Special Rapporteur on Health.
HIV is the gateway, the window, and the context in which that case was actually fought. There's no doubt about that. Because of HIV, we were able to get support from one of the ministries of the Government of India, the Ministry of Health, saying that if this section stays, it will actually impede the efforts of HIV prevention.
So in the end, you had a government department on your side.
We did, because we had lobbied with them. And they were working on these issues, and they found in reality what we were saying was correct. And they wanted this section removed as much as we did.
Framing the criminalisation of homosexuality as a hangover of British colonialism raises some rather sensitive questions about what Indian culture was like before the British arrived. Many religious leaders in India are not happy to see these questions raised, and India's Hindu nationalists are acutely sensitive about what they see as a Western tendency to view Indian men as effeminate and Indian culture as decadent. But addressing these kinds of issues is what the third era of AIDS is all about. Anand Grover says this is why the recent court ruling also marks the dawning of a new era for India.
It is indeed, because it's an imposition of the then British culture in India, which is against its basic ethos and values. And because it lasted for such a long time, even Indians started thinking it was part of their culture. Because not only in the religious text, but in practical terms, there are large communities of transgenders who engage in what we call men having sex with men. And they have been part of our culture for centuries. Our scriptures talk about them. They are revered in the scriptures. And the whole ethos and civilization which existed prior to the British and even before that had a completely different conception of sexuality, which was eroded and destroyed by various actors. And the final crowning glory was 377. And therefore, I think in civilizational terms, it is the dawn of a new era. One of the last yokes of imperialism has been now freed from our shores.
Meanwhile, former Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby says the vast majority of British Commonwealth countries still have laws on their statute books that criminalise sex between men.
All the countries that were part of the European empires, the French, the Dutch in Indonesia and others, didn't have these laws. It was the legacy of the British Empire, and even today, of the 53 countries of the Commonwealth of Nations, the British Commonwealth, 41 of the countries, 41 of 53 still have this so-called unnatural offences in their statute. And that's what makes the decision of the Delhi High Court so important, because the Delhi High Court said, well, that is a law which is a relic of 150 years of colonial time, but it doesn't stand with the modern constitution of India, which promises equality and privacy for all citizens, including homosexual citizens. And that is a message which is loud and clear, and I hope it spreads throughout the Commonwealth of Nations.
In fact, times are changing, and not just in India. This year, the Supreme Court of Nepal and the Supreme Court of Pakistan both issued rulings to protect the rights of hijras, or transgender people. And in Papua New Guinea, the Minister of Public Health, Dame Carol Kidu, who's also the only woman in the PNG Parliament, plans to introduce legislation to decriminalise homosexuality later this year, as she told this session of the conference in Bali. Legislative reform.
At present, the PNG law on sex between men, it comes from the Queensland Criminal Code, which came from the British law. And it's a 1974, as we inherited it at independence, but it goes back to the 1800s type law. These so-called offences were not recognised as such in traditional Papua New Guinea society. There were initiation ceremonies in some PNG societies that included male-to-male sex, and it was like ritualised homosexuality. In other parts of the country, sex between males was ignored when it occurred or regarded as something humorous, but certainly not seen as terribly wrong, I don't think, in our societies. We
did not. According to the director of the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations, Don Baxter, PNG is facing what's probably the most difficult AIDS epidemic in the world, with problems of geography, numerous tribal languages, poor education and low status of women. The AIDS epidemic in PNG is the only one in our region to be an epidemic of the general population. But Don Baxter says sex between men is likely to be a bigger factor in the PNG epidemic than is usually recognised.
Certainly on the ground, anecdotal reports are of extensive sex between men, including extensive rapes and gangbangs involving both women and men. And part of the reason PNG is really difficult, I think, and faces a very difficult task, is that because of the influence of the churches and the colonial powers and the fact that sex between men is also still criminalised, it actually means that the PNG society cannot talk openly about sex, and it's getting no leadership from its government to allow that discussion to happen.
Homosexuality is also illegal in many islands of the Pacific, including the Solomon Islands, the Cook Islands, Samoa, Tonga and Fiji. Based in the Cook Islands, journalist and broadcaster Myra Bopp Dupont is the founder of the Pacific Islands AIDS Foundation. She's been at the forefront of AIDS awareness campaigns in the Pacific since 1998, when she publicly revealed that she was HIV positive. Myra Bopp Dupont says it's not so long ago in the Pacific that political opponents of gay rights or gender equality used to argue that such ideas were a Western colonial invention.
One of the ministers in the Pacific, Minister of Government, once said when talking about human rights that human rights was against our culture, our traditions, therefore our identity, that it was something that was imported by white people who come into our country. I could relate to it to a certain extent because it is also how I have heard other people speak about it in my upbringing, that human rights is this foreign concept that foreigners are bringing, and particularly white people are bringing into our country and convincing us that it is the right way to go.
But Myra Bopp Dupont says attitudes about homosexuality in the Pacific are slowly beginning to change.
I think it's a colonial past, really, because it's a part of a culture from before the Christian religion. So what the missionaries brought with them, it's quite ironic that today we are living with laws that are based on values that were actually brought to us by the same white people who are today are telling us that we need to open up and think differently.
We're talking about complexity and we're talking really about deep social change. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about that?
I am optimistic. There has been a lot of change in the last 5 and 10 years. There's still more change to be, but you know, in the Pacific in particular, it's one thing to look at the law, it's something else to look at the actual social reality, which is that, for example, we live with gay people, we live with fafafines, with transgenders and all. For a lot of us, it's just part of the culture. Yet, the laws are against them. So we just need to build something that is us.
There are even signs that social and cultural attitudes may be starting to change in Africa, where the political leaders of Kenya, Rwanda, Namibia, Cameroon, Senegal and Mali have been backing away very, very quietly from the idea that homosexuality is un-African. If Africa is changing, it's likely that this is due, at least in part, to the influence of Michel Sidibe, the new Mali-born director of UNAIDS. Here he is on the phone from his office in Geneva.
I think it's changing because leadership is also changing, and because also we are having the courage to talk about it. Let us be very honest, and I'm saying that very modestly. Since I came, it has been one of my topic to talk about vulnerable groups. And being African, being also able to reach all the leaders of the continent, it is a topic I am putting on the table. When I went to meet the president of Senegal, when two gay men were judged and imprisoned for 8 years, when I discussed with him and we had the opportunity to look at the rationale of all of that, he was the first person to say, you know, Senegal is a country of law. And it's not possible. And they released them. And now they are rediscussing completely the context of their law. I just came from Rwanda, where the penal code is being revised. And I met the speaker, the president of the republic, the first lady, and other leaders. They are all trying to review a little bit how their law can be more supportive. I think it is a societal debate and is important. Africa cannot be out of those debates.
It's too early to tell whether these small changes in Africa will lead to something more substantive. But in the Asia-Pacific region, the winds of change are blowing stronger. And here the new director of UNAIDS, Michel Sidibe, points to the recent court decision in India, Australia's leadership in public health policy, and now also to the leadership of President Yudhoyono of Indonesia.
It's making all the difference. The effort and the speech of the President of Indonesia is talking about inclusiveness. I remember visiting Indonesia a few years ago, and in the train station, people were hiding themselves. Today, they are setting a goal, reaching 70% of the people who are drug users with services. This is amazing. Change is coming. Change is coming in China. Change is coming in Malaysia. Change is coming in different places. And I can say that those changes also have been initiated by effort made by Australia, demonstrating that the program for drug users can not just be cost-effective or evidence-based, but can save resources. The example of Australia is very clear, $1.5 billion saved because of well-targeted program and transforming people who are vulnerable and making them as actors of change. That's what we are calling for.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical operator Jenny Parsonage. Executive producer Kirsten Garrett. I'm Stephen Crittenden. And this is ABC Radio National.